The Primer of Love by Yvonne Bunyan. Yvlev was travelling once at the beginning of June over to the far side of his province. The tarantass, with its crooked, dusty roof, had been lent by his brother-in-law, on whose estate he was spending the summer. The three horses, small but sturdy and with thick matted manes, he'd hired in the village from a rich peasant. The latter's son, a dull-witted but confident lad of about 18, was driving. He was ruminating discontentedly over something all the time, seemed somehow offended, and didn't understand jokes. So, realising that there was no chance of any conversation with him, Yvlev gave himself over to that calm and aimless watching the world pass by, which goes so well with the rhythm of hooves and the tinkling of halter bells. At first, the journey was pleasant. It was a warm, dull day. The track had been worn smooth, and in the fields were masses of flowers and larks. A balmy breeze wafted over the corn and over the short greyish-blue rye, which extended as far as the eye could see. It was blowing pollen across the fields, puffing it up in places to form a source of mist in the distance. The lad, wearing a new peaked cap and an ill-fitting lustrine jacket, sat erect. The fact that the horses had been completely entrusted to him and that he was all dressed up made him particularly serious. And the horses were coughing and trotting unhurriedly, with the swingle tree of the left-hand horse now scraping against the wheel, now being jerked clear, while all the time the white steel of the worn horseshoe glinted beneath it. "Shall we stop at the Count's?" asked the lad without turning round, as a village suddenly loomed up ahead of them, its willow trees and an orchard masking the horizon. "What for?" replied Yvlev. The lad paused, and then, flicking a fat gadfly off one of the horses with his whip, answered, "To get a drink of tea." "It's not tea you're thinking about," said Yvlev. "You always feel sorry for the horses." "A horse doesn't worry about the journey, it worries about its food," said the lad didactically. Yvlev glanced around. The weather had deteriorated. Faded-looking clouds had gathered on all sides and it was already drizzling. Those unassuming days regularly end in rain. An old man, ploughing at the edge of the village, said that only the young countess was at home, but still they stopped. The lad draped a heavy peasant's coat round his shoulders and, happy that the horses were now resting, sat calmly out in the rain on the box of the tarantass, which had come to a halt in the middle of a dirty yard alongside a stone trough firmly embedded in the hoof-pitted ground. He kept examining his boots and adjusting the shaft horse's breastband with his whip handle. Yvlev, on the other hand, was sitting in the drawing room, which the rain was making darker and darker, chatting with the Countess and waiting for tea. There was already a smell of burning wood shavings, and thick green smoke was drifting past the windows from a samovar, which a barefooted wench on the porch was filling with bundles of wood chips, which burnt with a bright red flame as she poured kerosene on them. The Countess was wearing a flowing pink tea gown, which revealed her powdered neck. She was smoking, inhaling deeply, and constantly adjusted her hair, baring her firm round arms to the shoulder. Inhaling and laughing, she kept bringing the conversation round to love, and amongst other things, spoke about her near neighbour, Kovshinsky, who, as Yvlev had known since he was a child, had all his life been unhinged by love for his maidservant, Lushka, who'd died very young. "Ah, the legendary Lushka, Ivlev commented jokingly, slightly embarrassed at his confession. Because that crank worshipped her and devoted his whole life to mad dreams about her, I was almost in love with her myself in my youth, and used to imagine God knows what as I thought about her. Though they do say she was quite ugly. Yes, said the Countess, not listening. He died this winter. And Pisarev, the only person he allowed to visit him, for old time's sake, maintains that he wasn't at all unhinged in any other area, and I fully accept that. He just wasn't in tune with the people of today. At last, with extraordinary caution, the barefooted wench brought in an old silver tray with a glass of strong, greyish pond water tea and a little basket of fly brown biscuits. By the time they drove off, the rain had become really heavy. Ivlev had to pull up the roof of the tarantass and sit huddled under the stiff, dried-out apron. The horses' bells were rattling, streams of water ran down their shiny, dark haunches. The grass on the strip between the cornfields where the lad had driven as a shortcut was swinging under the wheels, and beneath the roof, the warm aroma of rye mingled with the smell of the old tarantass. So there we are, thought Ivlev. Kovchinsky is dead. We really must call in there, if only to peep in at the mysterious Lushka's deserted shrine. But what sort of a man was this Kovchinsky? Was he mad, or just slightly touched, a mind obsessed with one single thing? According to the older generation of landowners, Kovchinsky's contemporaries, he'd once had the reputation in the district for being an exceptionally clever fellow. And suddenly he'd been struck by this love, this Lushka, and then by her unexpected death, and everything had gone to pieces. He'd locked himself up in his house, in the room where Lushka lived and died, and spent more than 20 years sitting on her bed. He not only didn't go out, he didn't even show himself to anyone on his own estate. He wore out the mattress on Lushka's bed by sitting there all the time, and would ascribe to Lushka's influence literally everything that happened in the world. If a thunderstorm arose, Lushka had sent it. If war was declared, it meant that Lushka had decided it should be so. If the harvest failed, the peasants had displeased Lushka. It's Kovchinsky's you're going to, isn't it? Ivlev shouted, sticking his head out into the rain. Yes, to Kovchinsky's, the lad's voice echoed indistinctly through the rain. The water was running off his drooping cap. By Pisarev's hill. Ivlev didn't know that route. The region was looking increasingly remote and impoverished. The boundary strip came to an end. The horses slowed to a walk and pulled the tilting tarantass downhill along an eroded rut into some still unmown meadows whose green slopes stood out gloomily against the low clouds. Then the track, now disappearing, now appearing again, began to zigzag along the bottom of a series of ravines and through gullies thick with alder and willow. They passed a small apiary with a few hives standing on a slope and some tall grass dotted red with wild strawberries. They drove round an old weir overgrown with nettles and a long dried-up pond, which had become a deep gully full of weeds taller than a man. A pair of snipe flew screeching out of them up into the rainy sky. And on the weir, amid the nettles, stood a large old bush, one of those delightful southern woods which are now known as God's trees, ablaze with its pale pink blossom. And suddenly, Ivlev recalled the area and remembered that, in his youth, he had ridden through there more than once. They say she drowned herself here, said the lad unexpectedly. You mean Kovchinsky's mistress, I suppose, asked Ivlev. It's not true. She never thought of drowning herself. She did drown herself, said the lad, and I think he most likely went off his head because he was poor rather than because of her." Then, after a short pause, he added gruffly, "But we'll have to stop again. In that, in Kovchino, or whatever it's called, look how tired those horses are." "Please do," said Ivlev. The track, now pewter-coloured from the rainwater, brought them to a knoll on which, in a clearing amidst wet, rotting wood shavings and leaves, among tree stumps and young aspen shoots with their fresh, bitter sound, stood a solitary hut. There was no sign of life apart from a few yellow buntings which sat in the rain on some tall flowers and filled the entire sparse wood behind the hut with their song. But when the vehicle squelched through the mud and drew level with the hut, a whole pack of huge dogs, black, brown and smoky grey, rushed out and surrounded the equipage with their furious barking, jumping right up at the horses' noses, turning round in the air and hurling themselves almost under the roofs of the tarantass. At the same time, and just as unexpectedly, the sky above the tarantass was suddenly rent with a deafening thunderclap. The lad frenziedly lashed at the dogs with his whip, and the horses took off at a gallop through the aspen stumps which flashed past their eyes. The Kovchinsky estate was already visible beyond the wood. The dogs dropped behind, immediately fell silent and ran back purposefully. The wood opened out and ahead of them again lay open countryside. Evening was drawing in and it was impossible to tell whether the thunderclouds on three sides were dispersing or coming towards them. To the left the sky was almost black, though with patches of light blue. To the right it was grey and rumbled with incessant thunder, while to the west, beyond the Kovchinsky estate and the hillsides above the river valley, it was a dull dark blue and trailed powdery looking streaks of rain through which mountains of more distant clouds showed pink. Straight overhead, however, the rain was becoming lighter, and Ivlev, who was spattered all over with mud, stood up and with a feeling of pleasure pushed back the heavy roof of the tarantass to inhale the damp aromatic air of the countryside. He fixed his eyes on the approaching estate and at last saw what he had heard so much about, though it still seemed to him as if Lushka had lived and died not 20 years before, but almost in times immemorial. Along the valley, the trace of a shadow rivulet disappeared into the rushes, and above it flew a white gull. Further on, midway up the hill, lay lines of hay which had turned dark in the rain. Between them towered a number of widely spaced silvery poplars. The house itself, which was fairly large, stood with its shabby whitewashed walls and a shiny wet roof in a completely open space. There were no farm buildings or garden around it, just two brick pillars in place of a gate and masses of burdock in the ditches. When the horses forded the rivulet and climbed the hill, a woman in a man's light overcoat with sagging pockets was driving some turkeys through the burdock. The facade of the house was thoroughly featureless. It had very few windows, and those that existed were small and set deep in the thick woods. Yet the gloomy porches were enormous. From one of these, a young man wearing a grey school shirt belted with a broad strap was watching the approaching travellers. He was dark, had handsome eyes, and was very personable, though his face was pale and bright with freckles, like a bird's egg. They had to offer some explanation for their arrival. Mounting the porch and introducing himself, Ivlev said that he would like to examine and perhaps buy the library which, according to the Countess, the deceased had left. The young man blushed a deep red and immediately led them into the house. So, This is the son of the celebrated Lushka, thought Ivlev, running his eyes over everything they passed, frequently turning to look at something and saying the first thing that came into his head, just to be able to have another glance at the owner, who seemed too young for his years. The latter answered hurriedly but monosyllabically and became confused, evidently from a mixture of shyness and eagerness. That he was frightfully pleased at the prospect of selling some books and imagined they would fetch a high price was clear from his very first words, from the awkward haste with which he declared that no money could buy books like his. He led Ivlev through a semi-dark entrance hall, whose floor was strewn with damp reddened straw, and into a large anteroom. "Is this where your father lived?" asked Ivlev, taking off his hat as he entered. "Yes, here," the young man hastened to reply. "That is, of course, not exactly here, you see. He spent most of his time sitting in the bedroom, but, of course, he also used this room." "Yes, I know. I realise he was ill," said Ivlev. The young man flared up. "What do you mean, ill?" he said, and a more masculine note could be heard in his voice. "That's all gossip. He wasn't at all ill, mentally. He simply read all the time and didn't go out anywhere. That's all." "Now, please don't take your cap off. It's cold here. We don't live in this part of the house, you see." Indeed, it was much colder in the house than outside. In the unfriendly anteroom, whose walls were papered with newspaper, a vast quail cage stood on the sill of a window, gloomy from the clouds. On the floor, a little grey bug was jumping about by itself. Bending down, the young man caught it and put it on a bench, and Ivlev realised that the quail was tied up in the bug. Then they went into the hall. This room, with its windows facing north and west, occupied almost half of the entire house. Through one window, a centuries-old, completely black, weeping birch could be seen, standing out against the gold of the twilight sky, which was growing clear beyond the thunderclouds. The front corner of the room was completely occupied by an unglassed shrine, which was festooned with icons. Among them, one icon in a silver casing stood out in both size and antiquity. On it lay a set of corpse-yellow wedding candles bound with pale green ribbons. "Forgive me," Ivlev began, trying to overcome his reticence. "Was your father..." "No, not really," muttered the young man, suddenly grasping his meaning. "It was after she died he bought those candles and even started wearing a wedding ring all the time." The furniture in the hall was rough, but between the windows stood several beautiful cabinets full of tea services and tall, slender goblets with gold rims. The floor was covered with dry bees, which crunched underfoot. Also strewn with bees was the totally empty drawing room. Passing through the latter and also through another gloomy room with a stove bench, the young man stopped in front of a low door and took a huge key out of his trouser pocket. Turning it with great difficulty into the rusty keyhole, he threw open the door, muttering something, and Ivlev saw a tiny room with two windows. Against one wall stood a bare iron bedstead, and another, two little bookcases of Karelian birch. "So this is a library?" asked Ivlev, going up to one of them. And the young man, hastening to answer in the affirmative, helped him to open the bookcases and began avidly to follow Ivlev's hands. "Very strange books made up that library." Ivlev opened the thick covers, turning back the rough grey pages and read. "Magic landmarks. Morning star and nocturnal demons. Reflections on the mystery of creation. a wonderful journey to the enchanted land, and a modern book of dreams. And his hands trembled slightly. So this was the nourishment of that lonely heart which had locked itself away from the world forever in this tiny room and only quite recently left it. But perhaps this heart had indeed not been quite mad. There is a realm. Ivlev found himself recalling Baratynsky. There is a realm, though it has no name, neither sleep nor waking, but between. Our mind, once there, will lose its frame for the madness, for the marches of madness it has seen. The sky in the west had cleared, and a golden light shone from behind the beautiful lilac-coloured clouds, strangely illuminating that poor refuge of love, that refuge of an incomprehensible love which had transformed into an enraptured martyrdom a whole human life, which perhaps might have been destined to follow a quite ordinary course, had there not chanced to be Alushka with her mysterious fascination. Pulling a stool out from under the bedstead, Ivlev sat in front of the bookcase and took out his cigarettes, unobtrusively surveying the room and trying to commit it to memory. "Do you smoke?" he asked the young man who was standing over him. The latter blushed again. "Yes," he muttered, and tried to smile. "That is, I don't exactly smoke, I just treat myself occasionally. But, thank you, I'm very grateful." And clumsily taking a cigarette, he lit it with trembling hands, went over to the windowsill and sat on it, blocking out the yellow light of the sunset. "And what's this?" asked Ivlev, bending down to the middle shelf on which lay a single, very small book, rather like a prayer book, and also a casket with corners edged in age-tarnished silver. "It's... the casket has my mother's necklace in it," answered the young man, faltering, but trying to speak casually. "May I look?" "Of course, but it's a very plain one, you know. It wouldn't interest you." Opening the casket, Ivlev saw a worn string and a row of cheap, bright blue beads which looked like stones. And at the sight of these beads, which had once lain on the neck of the woman who was destined to be so adored and whose dim image could not but be beautiful, such a wave of emotion ran through him that palpitations made his eyes dance. When he gazed at it for a while, Ivlev carefully replaced the casket on the shelf. Then he turned to the little book. It was a tiny volume, charmingly produced 100 years before. A Primer of Love, or the Art of Loving and Being Loved. "That book, unfortunately, I can't sell," the young man just managed to bring the words out. "It's very precious. My father used to keep it under his pillow." "But perhaps you could let me just glance at it," said Ivlev. "Please do," replied the young man in a whisper. And, overcoming his embarrassment, though somewhat disconcerted by the young man's fixed gaze, Ivlev began slowly to turn the pages of the Primer of Love. The whole volume was divided into short chapters. On beauty, on the heart, on the mind, on signs of love, on attack and defence, on disagreement and reconciliation, on platonic love, etc. Each chapter comprised a number of short, elegant, and at times very subtle maxims, some of which had been delicately underlined in red ink. "Love is no simple episode in our lives," read Ivlev. "Our reason contradicts the heart, but does not convince it. Women are never stronger than when they arm themselves with frailty. We adore woman because she exercises sovereignty over our ideal dreams. Vanity chooses. Real love does not choose. The beautiful woman must occupy second place. The first belongs to the loving woman. The latter becomes empress of our heart. Before we realise it, our heart has become the slave of love forever. Then came interpretation of the language of flowers, and again certain items had been underlined. Wild puppy, sadness. Spindle tree, your charms are imprinted in my heart. Periwinkle, sweet memories. Geranium scenarium, melancholy. Wormwood, eternal sorrow. And on a blank page at the very end, a quatrain had been written in a minute, neat hand and the same red ink. The young man craned his neck as he looked into the primer of love and said with a forced smile, "He made that up himself." Half an hour later, Ivlev bade him farewell with a sense of relief. Of all the books he had purchased, only that tiny volume, and at a high price. The dull golden sunset was fading in the clouds beyond the fields, casting its yellow reflection in the puddles. The fields were wet and green. The lad drove slowly, but Ivlev did not urge him on. The lad was explaining that the woman who'd earlier been driving the turkeys through the burdock was the deacon's wife, and that the young Kovchinsky lived with her. Ivlev wasn't listening. He was still thinking about Lushka and her necklace, which had left a complex impression in him, rather like that he had once experienced in a small Italian town after looking at the relics of a certain female saint. "She's entered my life forever," he suddenly thought. And taking the primer of love out of his pocket, in the light of the sunset, he slowly read again the lines written on the last page. "Live by fair legends, say the wise men above, and bequeath to your scions this primer of love." Very best wishes and happiest of happy new years.